This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We talk Meta up 26% today.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. It's on track to post its biggest single-day gain in almost a decade. This after CEO Mark Zuckerberg laid out plans to make the social media giant leaner, more efficient, and more decisive. Hey, Carol, it also didn't hurt that the first quarter projected revenue is in line with analyst average projection, and that the company boosted its stock buyback by a cool $40 billion.
All right, let's get to it. Bloomberg News big tech team leader Sarah Friar is with us from our 960 studio in San Francisco. Sarah, of course, you know, author of No Filter, the inside story of Instagram. Sarah, unbelievable and eye-popping. We saw it when the company reported last night after the close. Fundamentally, did we get something new about Meta and its outlook last night?
Well, what was really new is just this change in tone from Mark Zuckerberg, because for the past year, he's been talking about the road to the metaverse and how it's going to take a long time and take a lot of investment, but eventually it will be worth it for all these investors. And the investors were looking at that and saying, are you looking at the economy, Mr. Zuckerberg? Like, do you see that this is not the time to be throwing your money at something that may not happen? And it seems like Zuckerberg has changed his tone. And in this call, he mentioned the metaverse barely, but he was mostly focused on what he called the year of efficiency, on getting rid of any sort of blocks to getting work done, becoming a leaner organization, getting rid of middle managers. Watch out, middle managers everywhere. And really making sure that they apply artificial intelligence to solve a lot of their problems, which I think was also an appealing buzzword for Wall Street. He said that he's going to use AI to make engineers more efficient. They're going to use AI to improve the targeting of people's content and the feeds, as well as advertising, to try to make up for the losses in their ad market from the changes to the privacy settings on iPhones. And I think it was just a lot more, Zuckerberg down to business, saying that he's going to create a more profitable, successful version of the company as it is today.
Sarah, should we question his commitment to the metaverse?
I think that we should expect that the metaverse commitment remains. I think that he's pretty obsessed with it, but he does seem to be walking back from the idea that this is going to be some big thing he should be talking about on these earnings calls. He's been talking about messaging for almost a decade now. I think 2014 is when he acquired WhatsApp and spun out Messenger into its own app. And it's just now that he started to talk about real numbers on messaging. So think about the metaverse in that context. For years and years, investors were asking, when are we going to see real money out of WhatsApp? When are we going to see real money out of Messenger? And he said, take your time, hold your horses, it's coming, it'll be big. Now he said they're at a $10 billion run rate, which doesn't mean much when anyone says run rate to you.
All right, thank you. That is so true.
Sarah, I'm going to have some fun with you. And did Mark Zuckerberg go to CEO school and all of a sudden say, hey, I've got to act like a leader of a massive company and I've got to think about costs and all those serious things that most heads of companies have to think about? And that's kind of how he came out.
Well, I think a little bit. I think the economy turned down and inflation and Ukraine and all those things that affected the ad spending last year. I think it's easy if you're somebody like Zuckerberg who has mostly led during growth. Like every time there's a downturn, every time someone says there's a downturn, tech survives, Facebook survives, Meta survives and continues to invest, and they have to invest through it. Well, I think this is a different scenario, and maybe they shouldn't have hired as quickly as they did during the pandemic, and maybe they shouldn't have spent willy-nilly on things that they weren't sure were going to be lucrative in the future. So I think they're trying to be more disciplined, and he doesn't really need to go to CEO school. He can see the stock drop last year, and all his employees can see the stock drop last year, and ask each other and themselves, what did we do to deserve this? What can we do to fix this? Because that's really the message that hits home for that base.
How much is Mark Zuckerberg looking over his shoulder at TikTok?
He really, I mean, that has been a key driver of a lot of the changes at Meta over the last year. We've seen them completely change the way that the algorithm works on Instagram and Facebook. We've changed the very meaning of what kind of content you see on those sites. It's not just your friends and family and the people you've chosen to follow. Meta is making suggestions for you, telling you that you might want to watch this or that video. In part, that was necessary because the regular users aren't sharing quite as much as they used to. So Zuckerberg needs to fill up that space with content that will keep you glued, and it seems to be working. Becoming TikTok, it may not stop TikTok's growth, but it will at least help juice Facebook and Instagram for the next generation.
We are living in interesting times, man. I feel like whiplash
today. Nobody in my feed on Instagram are people like I actually follow or know anymore. And yet I keep opening it up again and again, Carol.
You're one of those, huh?
Yeah.
All right,
I like to see the airplanes.
Sarah Fryer, thank you so much. Bloomberg News Big Tech Team Leader. Check her out on Twitter. You're listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Remember on Monday, the White House said that the COVID-19 national emergency and public health emergency will be extended to May 11th, but then lifted, and it's really a change or a sign of changing times. It's a milestone in a coronavirus response here in the U.S. that dominated much of the early weeks of President Joe Biden's administration.
Yeah, but at the same time, we're seeing the new variants are showing that they have an ability to evade protection provided by vaccines. We've got a lot to get to. Very pleased to have back with us Dr. Andy Pekosh, professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. On the phone from Baltimore, the Bloomberg School of Public Health, it is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Good to have you with us, Dr. Pekosh. Okay, so the national emergency ending May 11th. How should we read into that as people who are coming out of a pandemic, but also as people who need to understand, okay, well, who's going to pay for COVID tests now?
Yeah, so there's, I think, two major things that are going to go on here. One is, you know, people perhaps don't realize how many things the government was paying for to make sure that there was equitable distribution of vaccines, testing, treatments, healthcare for anybody that was infected with COVID-19. Much of that is going to go away when the public health emergency isn't in place. Insurance companies will pick that up, but it will very much depend on the types of insurance that individuals have. I think from the pandemic point of view, it's really a sign that we're moving into a phase that's moving away from the emergency responses and trying to put in place things to deal with COVID-19 as a disease that we're not going to get rid of, that's going to be with us going forward, and that we have to readjust our strategies to deal with it as a known constant concern that we'll have to use our public health interventions and our medical interventions to try to minimize severe disease.
Dr. Pekosh, is it fair to say it's just like the common flu?
No, you know, we had a big flu surge this year, and what that really showed us is that COVID-19 is still giving us more cases than influenza, and COVID-19 is still resulting in more hospitalizations and more deaths on a per-case basis than influenza. So it's something that is even more of a concern than influenza. We are concerned about influenza as a disease annually. So it's something we need to keep our eyes on, and we need to keep using antivirals, vaccines, and public health messaging to make sure that people keep their guard up against it.
To what extent do we need to be keeping our guard up against it? And I ask this in the context of our conversation that we had with Amish Adalja, your colleague at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, just a few weeks ago. And he really surprised me with his answer to my question about boosters, essentially saying that, you know, for many people, he wouldn't suggest a booster.
Yeah, well, you know, we are seeing that the severe disease is coming through in the populations we expect. The elderly, those with secondary medical conditions, those continue to be the at-risk populations. I think we run the risk of thinking about vaccinations against COVID like we do against seasonal influenza, and they're still very different diseases. So we still have a little bit to learn about how to best use these boosters, use these vaccines, but also understand that the virus is going to constantly be changing, and the boosters may not be as effective as we want them to be, nor will they be that effective over the course of a year.
What do you mean by that, that we run the risk of treating it in the same way? Is that, you know, in the comparison is we're given the recommendation to get a flu shot every year, but perhaps we don't need to get a COVID booster every year?
I think we probably will. The question is, at what time of year do we get that booster? COVID really hasn't shown the seasonality that we see with flu. So with flu, we get our vaccines in the fall because we know that in the late fall and winter, we're going to see a surge of cases. We still haven't seen that pattern with COVID-19. So we may need to adjust the booster time depending on when we see surges of cases.
Okay, so it is kind of interesting because I do think I'm thinking about, like, what kind of community immunity have we built up so far? Do we have any idea on that?
Yeah, we've built up a lot of immunity in the population. That immunity seems to be protecting more against severe disease than it's protecting against infection. So that's a little bit of a surprise, I think, for us. And I think it brings up what we're going to have to be dealing with, is we're going to be dealing with these cases that are going to be occurring perhaps across the entire year, and really paying attention to when the situation merits a booster, because we're seeing surges in cases, particularly in populations that are highly vulnerable.
Okay, so where does it leave us in terms of variants? Are we going to see variants develop that are continuing to be perhaps, more evasive for vaccines, but at the same time not have the strength that earlier variants had?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we're seeing the signs of right now is that the COVID variants that are emerging now have some ability to evade vaccine-induced immunity, but not a lot. And we think the virus is now sort of maybe moving in this little area where it's going to be responding a bit to the population immunity, but it's not going to make the major jumps like we saw when Omicron first emerged a little bit over a year ago. So signs are looking good that we're settling into a stage where the virus will be mutating, but we'll be able to adjust our responses in terms of vaccines and those strategies because we're not seeing major jumps in how the virus is behaving like we did during the first 2 years of the pandemic.
Is there a possibility that at some point in the future there could be a variant out there? I mean, anything's possible. I guess we know that. But are you guys talking about it, you know, a lot, that they could be the possibility of once again a variant that shuts kind of society down again? Or do we have a sufficient enough playbook that we can manage our way through?
Well, we are concerned about certain populations, for instance, immunocompromised people, who may be able to generate variants that are even more evasive or transmissible. A lot of efforts are being done to monitor those populations to look for those signs. I think the positive sign is that we know antivirals are working and we know how to update the vaccine. So even if a new variant emerges, the response in terms of treatments and vaccines will be much, much faster now that we know so much about how to deal with COVID.
still, oftentimes, often days, we see hundreds of people dying. When will that stop?
Yeah, and that's the big question that we don't have an answer to right now. It is important to note that we're having lots of people getting infected and dying constantly over the year. And that's something we haven't seen with the respiratory infection. All other respiratory infections come in waves. They're gone for long periods of time, and then they come and surge back, and then they leave. We haven't seen that pattern with COVID-19, and that's really the big variable that is going to impact, as we mentioned before, boosters and treatments and all those interventions that we have.
Well, it's an interesting time. It does feel better, but yeah, certainly something that we know we have to continue to keep on our radar. And we do actually when we think about China in terms of the reopening of its economy. Dr. Andy Pekosh, thank you as always, professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies, joining us on the phone from Baltimore.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
U.S. stocks, though, adding to yesterday's gains, sparked by speculation, the Fed's tightening cycle may be nearing its peak. You know, and we were hearing from Charlie talking about what's going on at the ECB and Bank of England, constantly global central bankers reminding us, hey, folks, there's more to come. We still got to fight to bring inflation down.
Well, it's perfect timing for this week's domestic cover story. The story written by Bloomberg News senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld and Bloomberg News chief correspondent for global macro markets, Liz McCormick. Liz joins us now via Zoom in New York City, along with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. The cover of this is perfect, Joel. It's clearly a Fed Chair Jay Powell staring down a bull. And I got to tell you, it seems like today and yesterday, that bull has the upper hand.
Yeah, well, that was why we wanted to do it as a cover story. When I think about this year and sort of the big stories of the year, this really does feel like it's going to be one of the big ones. Is, look, we've had the Fed that has been intent on continuing to raise rates. Wall Street really wants that cut at some point. When and how that all plays out is going to probably impact what the markets do all year long. So Liz, like we wrote it as a walk up and then yesterday unfolded. What do we know now that we didn't know going in, and how do you feel about how our cover stories hold up?
Oh, well, I think the story holds up. And like Tim said, as of yesterday, the market still kind of feels like they have the upper hand. Like Chair Powell, whether he meant to or not, he didn't kind of push back hard enough to kind of break the animal spirits that are out there. But I think, like you said, this is a like all year story. Like we're not going to know until, let's just say, the second half, if, you know, the markets will have capitulated if the economy remains strong and inflation is sticky and the Fed is making clear they are definitely not cutting, or if the world changes and we do get a full-fledged recession and the Fed starts leaning. So we're not going to know for a while. So like you can say round one market, Fed didn't push back, but I just think this is going to be going on for a while. And right now, I mean, maybe Chair Powell wanted just to leave kind of options open, but it was, you know, definitely interesting. I mean, especially in Europe, like Charlie was mentioning what's happening in the European Central Bank and stuff. The bond market rallied even after that, with Lagarde saying another 50 is coming. So the bond market just has this kind of bulls taking over.
Well, it's interesting, Liz, because you and Katie included a comment in this from Neil Kashkari, of course, the president of the Minneapolis Fed. And he basically said he's been around long enough to understand that there's this optimism when it comes to Wall Street. And it seems like optimism is what's driving this. But then you include this other part of this of his quote that he gave to the New York Times. He said, quote, "They are going to lose the game of chicken. I can tell you that." This is a guy who has been known as a dove and is now coming out increasingly in 2022 and this year hawkish.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Our Fed team in D.C. did a story a bit back saying, just like you're saying, Kashkari, who was the biggest dove, has like become the biggest hawk. And I was like curious. Oh, I'd love to call him. See, what did you think of what Chair Powell said yesterday? Because, you know, it didn't kind of embolden that chicken fight of the Fed winning. But yeah, I think it's pretty telling. And I just think that I guess the market is supposed to see ahead, especially the bond market. Sometimes they get it right. Sometimes they get it wrong. They've been kind of all over the place. But I mean, the market kind of sees the pivot. And we all know bonds got brutalized last year, as did stocks. So people felt like, oh, higher yields if the Fed, they want to get ahead of it. But yeah. You know, who knows at the end of the year, you know, who's in the red or who's in the green?
Well, what I love about the story, you know, Liz, is I feel like it's just a reminder that there's been some head fakes before, guys. And we got a little bit of exuberance, certainly, into financial assets, only to be disappointed with the Fed coming out and reminding us, hey, guys, you know, we're still raising rates. We still have to bring down inflation. Having said that, Liz, when is the point, you know, when investors, they're forward looking, right? You know, they're discounting, they're looking ahead. Is that the trade that we're seeing today? Or do you think, based on kind of where we are and what we heard from Jay Powell and company yesterday, they're getting too ahead of themselves, meaning financial markets getting too ahead of themselves?
Well, I will tell you, after yesterday, I scoured and read everything. I made a million phone calls because it's the question, right, Carol? Like, yeah. And I think a lot of people, there's people in both camps, even in the market, saying this has gone way too far. Some saying, yeah, bond market's supposed to get ahead. But there are people warning in stocks, like, well, if the Fed, even if they just stop one more hike, they're worried about earnings slowing down and that both things can't go up, stocks and bonds. So I don't know. I mean, March, we have a new set of dot plots, you know, where the Fed gives their forecast for the policy rate. That's going to be interesting to see. Like, they were at 5.1 in the median for the end of this year in the December dots. If that mm-hmm. holds again, which shows them saying no cuts, can the market keep going? You know, that's the big question. So, like, one of our folks, I'm forgetting names now, wrote a great piece saying, like, you can keep the dance party going, but maybe only till March. You know, let's see what happens then. There's a lot more data between now and then.
So let's talk about those dot plots, because that will be kind of the next moment that I think the you know, people are going to be all over this. And not to say Jay Powell might not need to talk again to cool down these spirits a little bit. But Liz, what do you think the market will be especially looking for in that next round with the Fed?
Yeah, I think it's if that median dot moves down from 5.1, which means they could do another hike and then maybe be cutting. Those dots could show. And that was one thing that happened yesterday in the press conference. He was asked about that. Like, basically, do you stand by those December dots? And he was like, well, you know, and the market didn't like that. He just didn't say, yes, we do. He said, you know, that's what we put at the time, where we'll revisit the data, which is fair. And, you know, so some people didn't like that. But I will add that he did say, and if things change, those dots could go higher. So it wasn't that he said they're going to go lower. So I think, you know, sometimes people in the market grab what they want to hear, and right. a little bit of like a Rorschach test, you know. So
well, what stayed with me was that he's like, we're going to bring it down to inflation. We're at the Fed funds, and we're going to get inflation back down to 2%. We heard that from ECB too, right?
2% seems real. Like, I was like, well, maybe it's 4%, maybe it's 3%. Nope. Like, no, it's going to be 2.
Exactly. So that was pretty clear. Great message, great story, great cover story of Bloomberg Business Week. So relevant to this week's news. Liz McCormick, chief correspondent for Global Macro Markets at Bloomberg News, writing it with Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld. And our thanks, of course, to Jill Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody. We are focused certainly on this rally. We're focused on the tech earnings after the closing bell. But, you know, as we talked with our Mike McKee earlier, we did get some economic reports earlier this morning, including reads on non-farm productivity. That was good, a rise in productivity. That helps the Fed to bring down inflation. But we also did get a read on the labor market, Tim.
Tomorrow we got a big labor number too coming. So the question is, does it show softness, that softness that the Fed wants to see? Let's get into it with Julia Pollack, chief economist at ZipRecruiter, with a jobs report preview and a survey of recently hired workers. She joins us via Zoom from Los Angeles. Julia, always good to have you with us. We've spoken to you in the past, and you and the other folks at ZipRecruiter have used the term that workers have been, in the last couple of years, in the driver's seat. I want to go back to that comment. Are they still in the driver's seat?
So the interesting thing about labor market data the last couple of months is that it's been like a roller coaster ride, with one month suggesting, you know, an imminent downturn and the next pretty rosy. So this week, things are looking up for the U.S. job seeker. We had productivity data show a big increase. We had job openings surge 600,000 to 11 million again. So there are 1.9 job openings for every unemployed American. We also saw the stock market pick up, consumer confidence increase, European economies doing better than expected. And so right now it looks like perhaps the labor market is still very tight. It's not softening, it's not slackening. And employers are going to get a rude awakening if they hope that bosses are back in town and that they'll be calling the shots.
Julia, give us perspective though. Are we back to 2019 levels pre-pandemic, or give me a little perspective here.
So some labor market indicators are tilting back to normal. For example, working hours and temp help services. So at the start of the pandemic, when there were these really acute labor shortages, employers were short-staffed and they had to squeeze as much productivity as possible out of each individual worker and excessively rely on contract workers, temp help workers, and overtime hours. That led to burnout, to a work-life balance crisis, and a retention crisis. Now we see that work week has fallen back down from 36 hours to 34.3 hours, sort of at the bottom range of what's good in normal times. Usually a decline in working hours is a bad thing. It shows that the economy is losing steam and that employers are cutting hours of workers and will cut actual headcount later. But this time, a decline may actually be good. It may show that the economy is recovering normal staffing, that companies are back at full steam and able to sort of restore normal practices again. So far, most of the indicators that have been negative, that have been falling, actually show signs of renormalization, rebalancing. The question is how far further they'll fall.
Well, all of this sounds pretty great if you're an American worker, of which there are tens of millions of those. You know who it doesn't sound great to? Is anyone on the Federal Reserve. Because if you're seeing JOLTS data like we saw yesterday that shows that for everyone looking for a job here in the US, there are 1.9 positions open, that means that there could be concerns about a wage price spiral. What do you make of it?
Well, so far in recent months, inflation has come down quickly, and it's come down more quickly than wages. But wage growth has also moderated. And so that suggests that a wage price spiral hasn't set in. That said, we now have a situation where in the last 5 of 6 months, U.S. workers have actually seen real wage gains because wages are growing faster than inflation, than prices. And so perhaps they'll now feel, confident again and ready to go out and buy. And that could drive prices up. So it's a delicate balance. And news that's good news for workers may be good news in the short term, but bad news in the long run if it fuels further inflation and forces the Fed to raise rates higher and keep them higher for longer.
Yeah, that's exactly where we are. We can each make the side of the argument. It's a tricky point, although markets certainly leading in a big way in the last day or so in terms of risk on and believing things are going to get easier and the economy will be okay. Julia, what are some of the interesting trends you're seeing when it comes to job postings on your guys' site?
So one thing we found very interesting was that new hires, people who just got hired in the last 6 months, got a better deal than those hired in the first half of the year. And that's surprising because there are so many indicators that the labor market has softened a little bit. Well, it doesn't seem to be the case when you look at new hires. 36% of them got recruited to their jobs. They didn't have to go out and look for a job. The job found them. About 20% of them got signing bonuses. That's very large historically. Then a huge share of them managed to migrate out of in-person jobs and into remote or hybrid jobs. 39% got a hybrid job. Only 28% were working in a hybrid situation before. 18% are fully remote. Only 12% were fully remote before. And those who are going into the office have managed to cut their commutes substantially from 30 minutes on average to 23 minutes. And so it seems like all around workers are getting a better deal.
They're getting a better deal, but I'm wondering if they're always going to be getting a better deal. I'm wondering if this is going to be a fundamental shift in the way that Americans have a relationship with work. Even in a downturn, do you still see employees having the leverage of saying, okay, I only want to come into the office 2 or 3 days a week?
So you do see a backlash among some companies. There are several companies in recent weeks that have announced return to the office 5 days a week mandates. Whenever this happens, though, many companies very soon have to backtrack because there's such a huge backlash among workers. You know, overall, we're still seeing the share of remote postings within high remote potential industries like tech and finance go up. Companies are increasingly shifting from taking over two floors in an office building to taking just one, from letting people work remotely on a case-by-case basis to sort of classifying the job as remote from the get-go. And so they're making the kinds of investments and policy changes that support long-term remote work. But it is a difficult issue, and they're also dealing with some of the challenges there for company culture and for productivity and collaboration.
What do you think is the biggest factor, or what are you focusing on in terms of maybe seeing a different trend line when it comes to the labor market? You sound pretty enthusiastic, I've got to say. So what would change that dramatically? Are you concerned about the Fed overdoing it here?
I'm very much concerned about the Fed overdoing it because we already see that it's had a large negative effect on business investment, on housing market activity. And if that continues, there will almost certainly be an effect on employment. So the question is, how far the Fed will have to go. For now, what the Fed has done has sort of almost miraculously, immaculately taken sort of froth out of the market, destroyed almost $12 trillion worth of value in the stock market and in crypto without causing real damage to the real economy and to Main Street. That's pretty remarkable. It's sort of almost a best case scenario. And the question is just how long that can last.
So I spoke about the idea of fundamental shifts in the way Americans work. What about when it comes to hybrid work and the idea that, Americans are now in an environment where it's likely that many jobs are going to allow you to come into the office sometimes. They're going to allow you to work from home, and they're only going to require a few days a week. I'm wondering, if you see that in an environment with layoffs, I have to go back to this once again, if you see that, that same mentality continuing.
Absolutely. So right now, layoffs are still so low by historical standards. I mean, they're down 24% below what was normal before the pandemic. There are only three sectors where that is not the case, and those are transportation and warehousing because of the shift back to services from goods, information because of the way the tech sector has been hit by Fed rate increases, and financial services. Of course, banking, deal making, IPOs have all been put on pause while the Fed is raising rates and sort of financial conditions are uncertain. Even in those industries, though, remote work is here to stay because it saves workers time and money, and it saves companies money as well.
Just real quick, does it also give companies an opportunity to hire people who they in past wouldn't have been able to hire? Is it more efficient?
Absolutely. Well, so many of our clients have converted jobs from fully in-person jobs to remote jobs or hybrid jobs, and they've seen recruitment expand dramatically. Their retention has increased, and wage growth pressures have fallen because they can now recruit across the country in lower cost places. So they have, you know, gain access to better talent at a lower price.
All right. Listen, we appreciate your time today. Julia Pollack, she is chief economist over at ZipRecruiter, joining us via Zoom from Los Angeles. This, of course, when we did get weekly jobless claims, we have been getting Challenger ADP data. And of course, we get the monthly jobs read from the government tomorrow, which markets are certainly focusing on in a week that has just been full of so much. And we've seen a lot more positive sentiment come back into the financial markets.
183,000 is the number expected tomorrow by economists surveyed by Bloomberg. That's down, Carol, only 3,000 from the last month of 186,000. We'll see if there are revisions, though.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. And we'll see what's going on with wages and the cost of wage increases. All right, this is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, we are keeping a watch on the markets, no doubt about it. Equity markets surging. They are off their best levels of the session, but we're seeing another leg up. This as investors wager that rate hike cycles on both sides of the Atlantic are nearing an end. We've, of course, heard from Fed Chair Jay Powell. We've also heard from ECB President Christine Lagarde, and also from the Bank of England. We've got big tech earnings. There's a lot going on, no doubt about it. And for more on where we are, at least technically, we've got Randy Watts. He's Chief Investment Strategist at O'Neill Global Advisors. Randy, Tim joining us via Zoom in Miami.
Hey, Randy, good to have you with us. How are you?
It's good to hear from you guys. I hope all is well in New York.
It is. So technicals, on a day like today, in a week like today, in a week like this week, in a year so far, where the NASDAQ composite is up 16%, what are the technicals telling you about this rally?
The market's tone has dramatically changed this year. It is a much broader market. Some of the growth sectors are starting to reassert themselves. You know, the Russell 2000 is up over 12% this year. This is all very, very positive. And while it's too early to say that a new bull market has started, these are the kind of things you see at the beginning of a big bull leg. So I think you have to interpret the data positively. And as you said a second ago, if you look at where the bond market is right now, it's dialing in an 85% chance of a rate increase in March, only a 40% chance of a rate increase in May. If you listen to what Powell said yesterday, he kind of talked about two more raises. If we get to the middle of the year and we're done with the Fed tightening cycle, I think the outlook for equities could be pretty positive.
Interesting. So, Randy, NASDAQ 100, we've been talking about it throughout the day, looking from bottom to top here, up about 20% here. What more do you need to see? Just seeing it alone isn't enough to say a new bull market is underway in tech?
I mean, I think what we'd like to see here is maybe a little bit of consolidation, either a sideways movement or a slight pullback. But we want to see these averages, both the S&P and the NASDAQ, stay above their 200-day. That's about 5% lower for each. But on the S&P, if you look at it technically, you're getting a positive cross of the 21-day and the 50-day through the 200. That hasn't happened yet in the NASDAQ, but we're hopeful that can happen over the next couple of months. So again, we're pretty positively inclined at O'Neill, and we're seeing a lot of, you know, positive action. And then finally, earnings, while coming in lower year to year, are not coming in dramatically worse than expected. So I think that's giving some strength to investors as well.
The bar was low though, right?
The bar was very low. They're coming in about down about minus 2.3. People were expecting down about 3%. So it is down, but it's sort of less bad than feared. And if we can go through this year, by the way, people are now essentially expecting flat earnings for the year for the S&P. So that bar has come down very low. I think everyone on the buy side expects it to be a down year for earnings. So as long as earnings don't absolutely crater, I think you're setting up for a very positive kind of second half of the year story for equities.
But it's not hard to find companies that are saying, hey, things out there are not so great. I mean, look at HanesBrands today. Shares are falling the most ever after the company said it expects muted consumer demand given macroeconomic uncertainty. We're going to hear from Qualcomm after the bell. Analysts are expecting a revenue decline of about 10%. Because of a worldwide slowdown in phone sales. Consumers are feeling the pain, so they're not, you know, buying expensive things like phones. There are some red flags out there. It's just a question of, to me, how far ahead the market is looking.
There are some red flags, but I don't think anyone expects this to be a good year for the economy or a good year for earnings. So the market's a discounting mechanism. So the question is, as we move through the year, is it going to come in worse or better than what's expected? I think importantly with the economy, the jobs picture is hanging in there. We're going to get unemployment tomorrow. The last unemployment read was 3.5%. People are looking for 3.6. While the economy is slowing, jobs are hanging in, and that means consumer spending is not totally tanking. If we can get through this rate cycle without jobs and employment falling apart, then in the second half of the year, you could be talking about a better economy in 2024. The market looks, 6 to 12 months ahead. So I think there's a lot of things that could happen over the next 6 months that could make you feel a lot better about the future. And that's very different than where we were a year ago, where we were thinking about what was ahead of us and was all negative things.
But we've had some head fakes. The cover of the domestic issue of Bloomberg Business Week is this whole idea of how investors at some point, Randy, have thought that the Fed was done. We saw that last year, only to be surprised that the Fed again wasn't done and was sticking to what it was saying. Why is it different maybe than what we saw last year?
Well, I think if you listen to Powell's commentary yesterday, he gave an indication that they think they're much closer to the end than they were. Second, some of the important inflation numbers are starting to come down. CPI is decelerating, PCE is decelerating, and importantly today, labor costs are decelerating. Labor costs last month were up 1.1%. The expectation was that number was going to be 1.5. And a month ago, that number was 2. So if labor costs can cool a little bit without having unemployment really spike, that takes some pressure off the Fed to keep raising. And again, if we continue to see the trend we've seen in CPI, which is deceleration, then I think we're on the right path. And I think the Fed is a lot closer to being done. I'm pretty optimistic the Fed tightening cycle is going to end this year.
Yeah.
And it's likely to end by mid-year, which is really not that far away now.
All right, Randy, thank you so much. Always appreciate it. Randy Watts, he's Chief Investment Strategist at O'Neill Global Advisors, joining us via Zoom in Miami.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.